From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Michael is now a post-tropical cyclone over the Atlantic Ocean. At its height, the storm was the most powerful hurricane to hit the continental United States in more than 25 years. At least 11 people died, five of those in Virginia, as Michael moved up the coast. The story is now one of recovery for devastated communities in Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. Here's Lance Hansen, a resident of Mexico Beach, Florida, speaking with NPR.
This is a war zone. How are you going to get out of here? This city is destroyed. The whole area is going to get, they're going to tear down all these houses and rebuild it. You're not going to recognize Mexico Beach.
Let's check in with NPR's Joel Rose. Hi, Joel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I understand you're at an emergency operations center just outside of Panama City. What are you learning?
Yes, as you say, I'm just a couple miles outside of Panama City here at the Emergency Operations Center, where first responders are sort of gathering from all across the region. The parking lot is, in fact, totally overflowing with vehicles, be they military, Coast Guard, utility companies. You know, it's spilling out into the neighboring, into the sort of the swampland and pines around the building. I've learned more, though, from my trip into Panama City, and I've just come back from, you know, going down into the city and really looking around at the damage, and it's pretty staggering.
A lot of the pictures that we've seen so far have been focusing on Mexico Beach. So is it as bad where you are in Panama City? Because in some places it just seems like homes and businesses are just totally wiped off their foundations.
The damage in Panama City is pretty extensive. I mean, I have never seen so many trees on the ground or bent over, power lines on the ground all over the place. I mean, you drive around the city and you just are constantly driving over them. Still, there's lots of debris in the roadways. You know, some houses seem like they're more or less okay. Others look like they're okay, except for they have a tree, you know, leaning on this, on the roof. And then there are other buildings where the wind just sheared the whole face of the building off. I mean, I saw several churches that were just, you know, utterly missing their facades or their sidewalls. And you could peer right into the sanctuary and, you know, see the pews from standing out on the sidewalk. I mean, you know, so it was really sort of house by house in a way, but, you know, some neighborhoods really, you could tell, bore the brunt of the damage. And you know, we've heard about Lynn Haven, which is a town just north of Panama City, and also some of the parts of Panama City that I got into today look pretty bad.
Now, we're seeing the death toll rise today across the region, but there's so much rubble out there. Is there a sense that there could still be a lot of people who are missing, still trapped underneath that rubble and need to be taken out?
I don't know that I saw that kind of damage in Panama City. I think, you know, I think the concern here is more sort of long-term, you know, can people live there? I mean, there's no power, and it seems like not really any great chance of power being restored in the near term. I mean, I think we're looking at weeks, if not months, given sort of the scale of damage that I'm hearing about, until power is restored. There's also no water throughout the city. There's no cell phone service, you know, except for this little pocket where I'm talking to you at, you know, from the Emergency Operations Center. You know, a lot of people don't have cell phone service. It sort of depends on which carrier you're with, but in general, communication is still just like a huge challenge. So, you know, I don't know that we're necessarily going to see a spike in the death toll from Panama City, although we could. I think it's more like the question is, like, when can people, how are people going to go forward and live there while they're rebuilding?
Well, and there must be some people there now. As you say, there's no power, there's no water. For the people who have stayed behind, how are they getting on? Where are they staying?
Well, hour by hour is how one woman described it to me. I mean, they're, you know, they've got bottled water. They're some of them who are making plans to have, you know, friends and relatives bring in supplies with them from out of town. Others are making plans to go and ride this out somewhere else until, you know, conditions are a little bit more hospitable on the ground. But this is, you know, it's you do see people coming back in to check on their houses. The roads have become like a little bit more navigable today, I think, than they were a day or two ago. But, you know, in some streets are still impassable with downed trees, and some people still haven't been into their neighborhoods to see their houses yet. So, you know, it's just early hours, really, in the recovery effort.
Yeah, that's NPR's Joel Rose outside of Panama City, Florida. Joel, thanks for your reporting, and stay safe out there.
Thank you.
Well, we had been planning a trip to Tallahassee in a couple weeks to report on the coming midterm elections from Florida. We're still going, but of course it's going to be a different trip. One of the stories we'd planned was on the oyster industry in Apalachicola, which is about 75 miles southwest of Tallahassee on the Apalachicola River, which feeds into the Apalachicola Bay on the Gulf of Mexico. It's a small town, about 2,000 residents, with a big history of producing oysters, supplying 90% of the state and 10% of the country. But because of different issues, water diversion away from the river, oil spills, over-harvesting, climate change, the native oyster reefs have been decimated. So younger workers were trying their hand at oyster farming, restoring the oyster beds by kind of planting them there. That was the story we were planning on doing, and now we're concerned about the ending. So yesterday we called up Apalachicola aquafarmer and oysterman T.J. Ward.
Hi, how are you?
Question is, how are you?
Well, for the circumstances, I'm doing fine. My family's good, and all our friends and neighbors are all well, too.
Well, that's what counts. But what are you seeing? What's the damage been?
The damage in Apalachicola is the worst I've ever seen, and locals that are older than me and been through more hurricanes haven't seen it this bad. Most power lines are down all over. You know, the surge was really, really bad on the riverfront. So,
And what does that mean for you, oystering?
Well, our wild oyster reefs are already devastated before this. I mean, the bay's not producing hardly any oysters whatsoever, but aquaculture farming is what I've been doing in the past year, and I haven't been able to get out on the water to see if I have anything left. I haven't even been able to get to our oyster house, which is 13 miles from Apalachicola on the coast, to see if it even exists because it sticks out like a sore thumb.
Into the water?
Yeah, okay. On Apalachicola Bay. So we do wholesale seafood as far as shrimp, and we do wholesale oysters, okay. And we have a seafood market. But our oysters are sold to mainly a restaurant down the street from our oyster plant called Indian Pass Raw Bar, which the last I heard took on 6 feet of water inside the restaurant. I mean, it took a hard hit from what I see here, where our homes are 3 miles, you know, off the coast, all the damage that's been done. Who knows what our oyster plant's going to look like.
Yeah. How does it work? You know, how do you oyster so that people can picture what you might have lost?
Well, our oyster reefs are, I mean, there's no shell. There's small oysters, which we call spat. And the way we harvest oysters in Apalachicola Bay, wild harvest, we use tongs, which are like rakes. Where there used to be at this time of year when the weather's not like it is, obviously, you'd have, you know, up to 500 boats every day on the bay. Now you have 6.
Yeah.
And that's just happened in the past 10 years. Complete devastation.
Yeah. And then this, do you think, I mean, we were going to come to your area. We are coming to your area to learn more about this. Is it going to be in any industry when we get there? I mean, what's your sense? Was this the death blow, do you think?
Well, the wild harvest already has a death blow, but for our company, which has pretty much only been dealing with aquaculture oysters the past, I'd say, almost 3 years now, depending on what's left, if there's nothing left, then our small business is done for at least a year or two for oysters.
And
right, I'd have to start all over again from the tiny spat, which we get, that's like grains of sand when we start raising these oysters, so it takes at least a year.
Yeah.
And also the infrastructure on our oyster leases, who knows, I mean, it might take another half a year before we could even get that set up for the spat.
Yeah. I hear you're third generation.
I'm about 5 generations, but in the last name Ward, I'm third generation.
And what are you thinking? This is not going to very soon get better, you know, because of warming seas, storms are going to increasingly get worse. What's your sense of what your future looks like?
Well, first off, I'm just glad that my family's, you know, okay after this storm, and, you know, my friends and neighbors. And every storm you learn, you had to adapt more. You have the pros of living where we live, and which is a great life on the water, and making a living off of the water outweighs times like this, because we always come back just as strong. I mean, we have no other choice. We're not going to leave here, and our plans are not to stop doing what we do, our way of life. So, and that goes for everybody in this community.
Hmm. The dog is voicing his approval.
Yeah, he is. Very much so.
Yeah. T.J. Ward there in Apalachicola, Florida. We wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we really hope that we can come visit. We had planned this trip anyway.
Definitely everyone woke up this morning and clearing roads all over North Florida, you know, where people can come back to their homes. And so maybe you guys will be able to make it here.
I hope so. I really hope so. Take care.
Thank you.
So that was yesterday. Since then, TJ made it out to the family oyster house, you know, the one that juts out in the water like a sore thumb. It is pretty destroyed. We will soon visit TJ and find out if the oyster crop was also wiped out and where they go from here. First Lady Melania Trump launched a social media frenzy when she said she's one of the most bullied people in the world. Here's a clip of her interview with ABC News correspondent Tom Yamas.
I could say I'm the most bullied person on the world.
You think you're the most bullied person in the world?
One of them, if you really see what people are saying about me. That's why my Be Best initiative is focusing on social media.
And she landed right into that aforementioned social media frenzy. Joining us for our weekly social media news roundup, Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera
Hello.
English. Hi there.
Look, that was catnip to Twitter.
It was.
And Facebook.
You know, most all public figures get a torrent of criticism. Michelle Obama was called an ugly monkey by a public official.
And those were the nicer comments.
Yeah. But, you know, in this case, bullying is a proud part of her husband's style. So what's been the response to this?
On the whole, people weren't taking the First Lady's comments particularly seriously. Frankie Sisti on Twitter, as an adult, your critics are trying to send you a message in how you are performing your job, which is ineffective at this time. Constructive criticism is not bullying. It is the right of the people. We pay for your travel and protection, and we are not gaining anything. Let me just switch over to Facebook. Ian Williams gives us a little quiz. I'm not sure if the correct response to the situation is A, womp, womp, B, thoughts and prayers, C, I really don't care, do you, D, be best, E, all of the above. He's going with all of the above. And one last comment to round up this little section. Becky Fortinot Rogers says on Facebook, I'm just going to sit here and watch you all prove her point, laugh out loud, underneath which is a meme of somebody eating popcorn, enjoying all the comments whizzing by.
Look, the New York Times writes that she's not wrong. I mean, she does, as other first ladies have, receive a torrent of abuse, hate-filled comments, those racy photos from her career as a model. But, you know, here she has this initiative. Maybe she should, I don't know, be thinking of the kids in school who are, you know, so bullied and don't have any protection. Somehow,
and a lot of those comments were coming out online about real people online and youngsters and people who are being bullied into suicide.
Yeah.
So that is a more serious aspect of what she's talking about. It doesn't mean that she's not being bullied, but she is a public figure and she is out there.
And maybe she could just sort of share with them that, you know, you're not alone. But anyway, on the topic of bullying, Instagram has rolled out some new technology. They say it's going to recognize bullying. Just tell us briefly what this is.
There's a filter, and the filter looks at either video or comments that they consider might be offensive to you, might be bullying. It's sort of like artificial intelligence, and that filter you can apply to your video and your comments in Instagram. And also, they have a kindness camera, which is another filter, and that filter will send out love and hearts and pretty pinkness and bright colours, and you can also get in a variety of different languages people saying nice comments back to you. When does that ever happen?
I think that's wonderful. You know what? We should link, Ashley, let's do this. We should link to a young man who had this initiative on his own of, you know, telling somebody that they're worthwhile. And it was wildly popular. So we'll link to that as well. Why not? You can get hearts and
let's disrupt
you.
Social media with kindness.
Yes, let's do it.
You're going to ruin it, Robin.
I have to ask you quickly about an uproar over a now deleted tweet from a user by the name of Blue Star Navy Mom 3. She made a post saying that her son was afraid to date in this Me Too era when, you know, he graduated number one in boot camp and was awarded an award.
Proud mama
number
tweeting
one,
about her son.
But he won't go on solo dates because of the current climate of false sexual accusations by radical feminists. So I vote hashtag him too. He responded what?
Well, First of all, people started memifying this comment because her son is a Navy vet, and he's, let's just say, he's not exactly hideous. He would probably be the opposite of hideous. That goes down very well on social media. People were memifying him too. When he found out, Peter Hansen is his name, he said, "That was my mum." Sometimes the people we love do things that hurt us without realising it. Let's turn this around, because all of this Twitter storm that was going around his mum saying him too. And he said, "I respect and hashtag believe women, and I never have and never will support hashtag him too. He's coming out as a feminist. I'm a proud Navy vet. I'm a cat dad and an ally. Also, Twitter, your meme game is on point. Have a look out for him on Twitter, at That Was My Mum. He's using his Twitter fame wisely. He's doing philanthropy, and he's
fantastic.
Not exactly hideous.
Femi, okay. Host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. I'm sure there will be a conversation there. Femi, thank you.
You're welcome.
And during a surprise inspection of California's Adelanto Immigration Detention Center, officials found nooses made of bedsheets and a litany of other health concerns. The Inspector General's office at the Department of Homeland Security published a harsh report this week detailing problems inside the building. A private company runs it for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It houses up to 2,000 people waiting for their immigration cases to be decided. Joining us now is Paloma Esquivel. She's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and she's been covering the story. Paloma, welcome.
Thank you.
This was a shocking report to read. Inspectors found nooses made of bedsheets in 15 cells. How is that possible?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think that the reason that the Office of Inspector General issued this management alert saying these sort of were issues that needed to be addressed immediately because, you know, a year ago, a man killed himself at the detention center using bedsheets, and there have been two other attempts also using bedsheets. So I think when the inspectors with the Office of the Inspector General walked through Adelanto on this surprise inspection and found that these knotted bedsheets were just hanging from vents in so many cells, I think there was a sense of urgency that this needed to be addressed.
Should we imply then that many people inside this facility were suicidal, or could they have been for some other reason making those nooses?
Yeah, I don't think so. You know, people told the inspectors that they used them for various reasons. They said that they would unfurl the bed sheets to give themselves privacy, that they would use them as sort of clotheslines. But they were also told by one man that he had seen suicide attempts using these nooses, and that the guards sort of laughed them off and called them suicide failures when the attempts weren't successful. So no, I don't think that it was the case in every person's case, but it's clear that this has happened before and that officials were aware of that.
And it wasn't the only problem inside that building by any means. What else did you find?
Right. So the other things that the Office of the Inspector General highlighted that they found during this unannounced inspection in May of this year was, you know, one of the big things, and this has been an issue in Adelanto for years since it opened back in 2011, was questions of untimely and inadequate medical care. And then the other problem that they highlighted was improper and overly restrictive use of segregation. And you know, the thing about immigration detention is it's supposed to be what they call civil detention. It's not criminal detention. It's not supposed to be punitive in nature. And so there are national standards that sort of govern how that's supposed to happen. And so when you're using disciplinary segregation in ways that are more punitive, that becomes a problem.
Well, we also learned that doctors stamped their names on patient records without ever seeing the detainees. A dentist said that he didn't have time to do fillings and that detainees could just use string from their socks to floss their teeth.
Right.
What does the law say about what kind of medical care they're supposed to be receiving?
Immigration detention is governed by what are called these performance-based national detention standards, and that governs everything about medical care that detainees are supposed to receive. And obviously, this care is supposed to be timely. You know, it's supposed to be adequate for these detainees who have no choice but to rely on the care that they're given inside these facilities. And in Adelanto, in several government inspection reports over the years, again, since it opened in 2011, the facility has failed to meet these standards. So this is not the first time that this has been an issue.
We should point out that Adelanto is owned by a private company, the GEO Group, and it's very, very common for the federal government to contract these detention centers out to private companies. You mentioned they have a history of problems. What is the company saying? I mean, is anybody being held to account for what the inspector general found?
The company initially did not respond when we did our story about the Office of Inspector General's report. But after that, they did send me a statement saying that they took the report very seriously. They also said that they felt that a number of the findings lacked appropriate context or were based on incomplete information. But they said that they were taking steps to remedy the areas that the inspector general had been concerned about.
In Arizona, a federal jury recently convicted a former employee at an immigration shelter for minors accused of molesting boys there in that facility. There's been other suicides around the country, including last year at a facility in Georgia. I mean, look, this is not just in California. This is a widespread problem across the country, it seems like.
Right, yeah. And last year, actually, the Office of Inspector General had a broader report looking at, I believe it was 5 detention facilities where they were raising concerns about the treatment and care of detainees. So, this is not an issue that's isolated to Adelanto.
And what's ICE saying?
ICE, again, is also saying, you know, that it takes the report very seriously and that it is working to address the findings. They also mentioned that there will be another inspection this month to ensure compliance with all of the national detention standards.
That's Paloma Esquivel, a reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Paloma, thank you for your reporting. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The stock market opened higher this morning after 2 nail-biting days on Wall Street. The Dow Jones fell 5.3% over Wednesday and Thursday, its worst performance since February. So what's going on? Were those drops the beginning of the end for the bull market or merely a correction? Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Robin.
So the market did start off higher today. It's now back down a little. Analysts have been telling us the drops over the last couple of days were a reflection of concern about Trump's trade wars. But President Trump is saying it's the Fed which has raised interest rates a little bit as the economy has heated up. Others have agreed with that. What do you say?
Well, it's interesting, Robin. I've been trying to explain the stock market for a good 12 years now. And I'll tell you, there are some days when I can tell you with 100% confidence what's going on. And there are other days where the confidence is a little bit lower. This week, I would say it's sort of that lower confidence. And certainly, there are things you can point to for the initial weakness that we saw in the market starting about 3 weeks ago. The rapid increase in interest rate. There were a few companies that came out and pointed at the tariffs on China as affecting their earnings. And there was also this story from Business Week about China installing these secret chips on some company servers. All of that really got the ball rolling. But once it started snowballing, it's very hard to explain specifically what caused it. There's theories that there are hedge funds, computerized hedge funds that react to stuff like changes in the momentum of the stock market or the volatility. And they tend to sell aggressively when those things shift into a new regime. So the prevailing theory is that it started with concerns about interest rates and trade, and then the selling got a little out of control by some of these computerized systematic strategies of some of the quant hedge funds in the world.
So what overall would you say about the economy? Because, you know, it seems to be going great guns. And, you know, unemployment is low. So where are we?
Yeah, I mean, the current state of the economy, that's all true. There is quite a bit of uncertainty about how high interest rates are headed and what the ultimate impacts of the trade tensions between the U.S. and China will be. So whenever there's uncertainty, even though right now things are going great, that uncertainty really can add to the volatility in the stock market specifically, like we've seen over the past week.
Well, the Fed has kept interest rates far below, you know, historic definitions of normal. I mean, they were super low after the crisis to try to get the economy rebounding. And isn't the thinking that as an economy heats up and the engine really starts to heat up, the Fed acts as a coolant, you know, by raising those interest rates just a little bit? But then we hear President Trump calling the Fed loco and too stringent. So what's, from your view, what's true?
Well, right. I mean, the Fed is doing what you said. The risk is that the economy overheats and that inflation gets too high, and that can basically cause a hard landing in the economy. It can cause sort of a reversal of these trends we've seen. I think for President Trump, he views the stock market as sort of his alternative approval rating.
Right.
And he's very interested in keeping it high. So yeah, he's not happy with the Fed.
Others have learned, do not lash yourself to the stock market. It's a mistake. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
There are new reports that missing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered. The Washington Post is reporting that Turkey has audio and video proof that he was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Khashoggi wrote columns critical of the Saudi government for the Post, and he hasn't been seen since he entered the consulate more than a week ago. His disappearance has raised questions about the close relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us now from Istanbul. And Mark, you have your own reporting that's similar to the Post. What are you hearing?
Yeah, Peter, a source close to the Turkish investigation has said Turkey has got documented evidence to support the claim of state-sponsored murder of Jamal Khashoggi when he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul 10 days ago. The source also tells us that Ankara's official position is still that Mr. Khashoggi is missing, but that Turkish intelligence knows for sure that he was murdered. Now, that backs up the American news reports of that audio and evidence. Audio and video evidence, the recordings showing that Mr. Khashoggi was not only killed but also interrogated and tortured before that. There are very gruesome details coming out, including recordings allegedly of him being beaten and some reports that his body was dismembered. The Saudi officials, Saudi authorities, are still flatly denying all the allegations.
How reliable, generally speaking, is Turkish intelligence?
I would say that it's pretty reliable in terms of what they leak to Turkish pro-government media. There's a slightly strange communication strategy with this government here in Turkey, where they don't really speak directly to foreign media, for example, and they don't actually have a proper kind of communications department, but they do leak through the state media. So I think what's happening at the moment, Peter, is that the Turkish government is maintaining a slightly more cautious approach. So, for example, Turkey has welcomed in Saudi officials here to be part of a joint Saudi-Turkish investigation that the Saudis had proposed. That is the Turks playing nice and saying, look, we don't want to blow up our diplomatic relationship at this stage, but they are leaking incriminating evidence on a day-to-day basis and therefore tightening the screws on the Saudis and trying to get the Western backing for the Turkish position.
The question about that joint committee, the Saudi-Turkish investigation, has to be how credible it can be if it includes the Saudi government.
Yeah, and I think that it's sort of basically been compared to, for example, if Donald Trump were to set up a joint cyber crimes inquiry with the Russians. I mean, I really think that this is kind of a diplomatic nicety on the part of the Turks entertaining the Saudis on this, but they are pretty clear that they have got the evidence to back up their explosive allegations.
And there is some more irony here as well, that Turkey is pushing a case that a journalist was murdered on its soil, while at the same time the country is one of the world's biggest jailers of journalists. Are people noting that at all?
The biggest jailer of journalists. I mean, yes, it has been noted particularly by Turkey watchers such as us. But, you know, that said, Turkey is not treating journalists in the same way as this journalist is alleged to have been treated. I.e., we're not talking about murdering here. We're talking about how Turkey has locked up journalists, which is obviously also an attack on press freedom and completely unacceptable by attack on liberal values. But there is some distance still between the two cases, I think.
Here in our country, I mentioned that this case is threatening U.S.-Saudi relations, which have been very, very close over the years. But from your perspective there in Istanbul, how much is this case threatening the diplomatic order across the region?
Well, I think that Turkey is very aware that you know, the relationship with Saudi Arabia is important. It doesn't want to destroy that relationship at this stage. But I think that, you know, that clearly Turkey's not going to sit back and simply accept what is, in effect, a flagrant violation of its sovereignty. It wants support from the U.S. and from other Western governments in taking a tough line towards the Saudis.
And speaking of diplomacy, there's one other breaking news story I want to ask you about today. U.S. pastor Andrew Brunson, imprisoned in Turkey for 2 years, has been released today by the Turkish government. What are we learning about that?
Yeah, this is a country that produces more news than it can consume, really. American pastor Andrew Brunson, he was detained in a massive purge after the failed coup here in 2016, accused of supporting terrorist groups. He, his family, the American government have always said that's completely baseless. They put pressure on the Turks to release him. President Erdogan has always maintained he could not interfere with the independence of the Turkish judiciary, which is seen as laughable by critics of Turkey. And what's happened today is that he has finally been released. He was sentenced to a 3 years, 1 month, 15-day sentence, which basically corresponds to the time already spent in custody. So Andrew Brunson will finally be able to go back to the U.S. It was the source of massive friction between the U.S. and Turkish governments, sanctions, tariffs, and the plunging of the Turkish currency. That is all now expected to ease to some extent.
And it will be seen, most likely, as a diplomatic victory for the Trump administration. The BBC's Mark Lowen in Istanbul. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Now back to the U.S., where a candidate in Georgia's hotly contested governor's race has been hit with a federal lawsuit. Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp is running for governor, and he was sued yesterday by groups that say his office is jeopardizing the votes of some minority residents. Kemp's campaign denies that it did anything wrong, but his opponent, Democrat Stacey Abrams, is calling on him to resign as Secretary of State. Jonathan Brader is counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. It's a nonpartisan group that advocates for voting rights. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The reporting is that Kemp's office stalled the registrations for 53,000 mostly black and Hispanic voters based on a law known as exact match. What can you tell us about that?
Exact match is a policy by which if all of the information on a voter registration form down to the digit or hyphen doesn't match perfectly with existing data in driver's license or Social Security information, the voter registration form is put on hold and in some cases rejected entirely.
Do most people on that list know that they've been excluded?
They're supposed to get a notice in the mail, but oftentimes people don't receive those or understand what they mean. And so the burden is then placed on the voter to fix this problem, which in other states would not affect their eligibility or voting at all.
Okay, so in total, Kemp's office, Secretary of State, has canceled nearly 1.5 million voter registrations since 2012. His campaign is saying that he's making sure that only legal citizens cast a ballot and that it has never been easier to vote in Georgia. What do you make of that? Are you aware of any voter fraud problems in Georgia on a significant level?
There's no significant evidence of voter fraud in Georgia. And although voter list maintenance is important, there's no connection between aggressively purging the voter rolls the way Georgia has and making elections more secure.
Kemp is also putting a fair amount of the blame here on Stacey Abrams, his Democratic opponent. She started a voter registration group in 2013 called the New Georgia Project. And Kemp is making the point that in the process of signing thousands of people up through that project, they did a sloppy job and that he was just pulling out those improper registrations. I mean, does Stacey Abrams and her group deserve any blame for maybe doing this in a poorer fashion?
Voter registration drives are a vital lifeline to get certain communities who don't have as much access to government offices registered to vote. If there is information missing, which sometimes happens, the state should do everything they can to resolve those discrepancies. What Georgia is doing is making it the voters' burden to resolve that problem instead of trying to fix it themselves.
Do you think a candidate who's running for governor can independently also be the Secretary of State?
Well, it's happened before in other states. I don't think this is a unique situation. I think that one of the concerns is that as Secretary of State, Mr. Kemp has made some controversial statements. There was a statement he made several years ago expressing dismay about some voter registration drives, and he's been accused of politically motivated investigations. So that's certainly a concern in Georgia specifically.
And just to be fair, I want to add something else that Kemp has said. He says that Georgia has broken a record this year for voter registrations with nearly 7 million new voters added to the rolls. I want to also ask you to expand this beyond Georgia. How common are exact match laws around the country?
There's a couple of states that have some version. For example, Florida has a version of this, but they will go back and look at the voter registration form and try to resolve the difference before they put it back on the voter and put the voters at risk and give them the responsibility to fix the problem.
And by the way, the polls are showing this race neck and neck, so every vote is going to count in November. Jonathan Brader, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks again for having me.
It's been two decades, but the ashes of Matthew Shepard are finally being laid to rest. The remains of the openly gay University of Wyoming student will be interred at the Washington National Cathedral later this month, and his parents say they're happy and relieved. For years, they'd searched for a safe place, worried that if he was buried, protesters might desecrate his grave. His final resting place is fitting. He was once an altar boy in the Episcopal Church. Well, it seems like just yesterday, but it was 20 years ago when Matthew Shepard was robbed, beaten, tied to a fence near Laramie, Wyoming, and left to die because he was gay. One of the most enduring legacies has been the wide and diverse collection of artistic responses. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim has more.
Ordinary Boy is in the prologue of Considering Matthew Shepard, a three-part orchestral and choral work. It was written by Craig Hella Johnson. The concert moves through the life and death of Shepard and the resulting trial of his two killers, alternating in genre and perspective. In the production, Johnson wanted to show that Matthew Shepard was more than a story.
I've got to include Matt in this piece, not just Matthew Shepard, the iconic name.
The concert is touring the country now. It's the latest major contribution to the canon. Shepard's death compelled a lot of artists to respond in unique ways over the past 20 years. Countless paintings, musical interpretations, poems, and theater. It's even been a story arc in popular TV shows like Six Feet Under and West Wing, like when a representative from the show's president confronts the victim's parents.
Lady, I'm not embarrassed that my son was gay. My government is.
Art has become central to the story of Matthew Shepard's death. Johnson says it allows something deeper than just reading news clips.
We come together. We grieve together. We ask our questions together. So that alone is one, you know, significant aspect of a way that performance and performance art, music, can hold a story and give us deep possibility for processing.
The first major artistic work to do that was the Laramie Project. That's the city where Shepard was killed. Lee Fondakowski is the head writer. She was in Laramie just weeks after the attack, talking with locals and gathering interviews. She says the play is still relevant today. It continues to be wildly popular, especially in high schools. Like Johnson, she sees art as playing a role in the conversation.
the art, I believe, kind of elevates the discourse or elevated the discourse so that we could really look at it from many, many different perspectives and come to a deeper understanding, both of the magnitude of the loss and the meaning of the loss.
Fondakowski doesn't think the Laramie Project was necessarily the reason for all the art following it. She says the tragedy was bound to galvanize artists.
There was something about his heart, his, you know, I can't think of any other way to say it, just his light, his life force. There was something that just moved people to want to investigate further and to want to make art by.
It's been 20 years since Shepard's death, and artists have had the time to investigate unanswered questions. Some wondered where Shepard would be now at age 41. Others explored the religious aspect of his death, seeing it as a crucifixion and him as a martyr. Poet and author of 70 books, Leslia Newman, was coincidentally in Laramie to speak about gay rights the day Shepard was killed. She had her own burning question.
What happened at the fence? Now, Matt, of course, can't tell us because he is no longer with us. So then I had the aha moment. There were witnesses. The fence was there. The moon was there. The stars were there. Animals were there. What could they tell me?
So in 2012, she published her book, October Morning, A Song for Matthew Shepard. It's told through fictitious monologues from perspectives like the stars, the fence he was tied to, and passing animals.
And really just tried to come up with some truth. Not the truth, but my truth.
Jason Marsden is the head of the Matthew Shepard Foundation. He was also a friend of Matthew Shepard. He imagines the stories, artwork, and poetry will help this story live on.
Like all historical events, memory of it will fade if there isn't some compelling and emotionally powerful way to keep the story vivid to people. People in high school now weren't alive when Matt was murdered, so these works are the only way that people will ever have a vivid, emotionally resonant experience of this story.
Marsden says the artwork has changed since the event in 1998, with more context, new perspectives, and distance. But that even new works, like Considering Matthew Shepard, are a gift for anyone who continues to fight for equality and acceptance. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McKim in Laramie.
Out and alone on the endless empty prairie.
And Cooper's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
The wind soothes me.